Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Carlos for Mr. Haas, the appellant. How are you this morning? I would like to use my time to discuss the two issues I feel are important in the case, one being the errors in the admission of the NFA and CFTC sanctions, as well as the restitution issue regarding universal currency fund. As the Court is aware, this particular investment vehicle involves a foreign currency exchange. My client, Mr. Haas, was involved in an investment vehicle through the Universal Money Traders. That was an unregulated activity in the foreign currency exchange. He got people to invest with him. Basically, he was a coach at a place called Rancho Santa Fe Christian. People came to him knowing that he was involved in this and actually became part of this vehicle.
Well, it also came to him because there was representations of his prior activities and a spotless record.
Well, not so much this prior activity. He did mention that he had experience in actual finance. However, right. He didn't ever...
And all that experience was good. He was an absolute genius.
Yes and no. Later on, he did actually disclose some of his sanctions that he did have. However, he did tell them that he didn't have any experience in the foreign currency exchange market, and in fact that it was unregulated. What happened in the case then was that there were sanctions that were imposed by the NFA and the CFTC. The district court allowed the admission of these both as substantive evidence as well as 404B evidence. We objected to the admission of it under the 404B analysis. Because the NFA sanctions and the CFTC sanctions were, in fact, not convictions, they were administrative hearings, administrative settlements. Starting with the NFA sanction, that particular sanction was what's called a settlement agreement. There was no requirement, there was no actual admission of wrongdoing. He settled with them.
But as I remember the record, he told his investors that he had a spotless record. He didn't tell them at any point, I've been sanctioned by NFA or by the other administrative agency, did he?
Did I miss that? There were some witnesses who testified that he did make representations of that. However,
he made representations of a clean slate. Were there any witnesses who said, oh, no, the moment I met him, he sat down and he said, by the way, I've been sanctioned by NFA and I've been sanctioned by the other agency?
Well, he didn't. He didn't.
No, of course he didn't.
Of course he didn't. And I think what we need to analyze this to is if the foreign currency exchange trade is not regulated by any body, you don't have to be regulated by NFA, you don't have to be regulated by the CFTC.
If an attorney makes a representation that he's never been questioned or sanctioned by the Bar Association, he has a spotless record, right? And then later it comes out that that's not true. Is that not misleading?
Absolutely. However, if that attorney, let's say the attorney were sanctioned, were privately reproved by the State Bar for having a conviction for
even privately reproved. If it depends on the scope of his first representation.
The nature of the representation. Is there a
duty
to disclose that?
No, scope, what he said. He said, I've had a clean record. Nobody's ever laid a hand on me. Nobody's ever sanctioned me. Nobody's ever reproved me. And he's gotten some reproval.
Right, but not to everybody that's involved here. And I think that's the issue. If there were individual investors who said that this is what he told me, that I had a clean slate, that I'd never been sanctioned. But let's go back to the attorney. If an attorney were privately reproved for a conviction for petty theft, which is a moral turpitude offense, that doesn't have to be disclosed to a client. If you're privately reproved, it's not...
I get your argument, counsel.
Right.
Let's move on.
You can continue to represent them. You continue to do things professionally. And that's the same thing in this case. These are administrative hearings, a lower standard of evidence. He was not required to disclose this information to individuals in the foreign currency
One
exchange.
One of them was a settlement, right?
Pardon?
One of them was a settlement.
Settlement agreement, correct. I think they both were settlement agreements. One of them had findings, and then they basically agreed to accept the findings. One of them was in a supervisory capacity, and the other one had to do with an individual client. But in any event, both of these were outside of the foreign currency exchange. There was no duty to disclose those. And he, in fact, did disclose them when we get to the UCF, which did require disclosure because it was regulated by different bodies. And in that case, he did disclose, he was disciplined, and he also gave the information of where they can contact the NFA. And I think as we talked about in our brief, a small amount of due diligence would have contacted the NFA, would have shown any investor that, in fact, he had been sanctioned by these bodies.
Is there any regulatory body that regulates who can, who and how investments in foreign currency can be made?
No. It's an unregulated market. It's an unregulated market with, at the time, I mean, it may have changed since then, and I'm sure the government can tell you, but at the time of this trial, at the time of the offenses, it was unregulated. In fact, Mr. Haas, regardless of any, he could have had a string of NFA sanctions and findings and settlements. He still could have traded in this particular market and still did not have a duty to disclose that unless he told people, I've never been sanctioned by the NFA, unless he told people that I've never had a situation where a body has sanctioned me, and that just wasn't the case.
Well, but he did say he had a long and supposed history since 1987 in financial markets. He had a website that had said he had the highest degree of ethics and responsibility and great performance history since 1993. He represented he had high returns in 99, 2000, and 2001. That wasn't even in the same entity, and that's when the violations occurred. And I guess the bottom line of what you're saying is because the government doesn't have an entity which does this, this is all civil, and we entered into a settlement about it, I don't have to say anything.
Well, not necessarily. What I'm saying is that they were admitted into the record and they admitted against Mr. Haas when, in fact, they didn't have any bearing on the case itself.
I guess I'm having a tough time again seeing how it didn't have any bearing at all when he's saying since, say, 87 he has a successful history. Since 93, he's the highest degree of ethics and responsibility, and he's had high returns in 99, 2000, and 2001.
Well, any high returns, whether he's been sanctioned by the NFA or the CFTC, which are different bodies, has really no bearing as to whether or not he's making a false statement as to his high returns.
That's what you're asking me to suggest. Right. Because they're not government agencies?
No, not necessarily. What I'm saying is that if you get into a trial, you get a jury hears about these sanctions by a government board, they equate them to a conviction, which is totally different from what happens here. I mean,
and counsel just sits around and lets them do it?
Pardon?
Counsel just sits around and lets them do it? Or doesn't he point out these are not the same?
I did do that.
All right. You pointed it out, so they had in front of them what the deal was.
That's not necessarily because the jurors don't look at, I mean, they look at the government as being all powerful, and the government decided that this person had engaged in wrongdoing, therefore he's involved in all of this wrongdoing.
I see.
And just before I run out of time, I would moving over to the UMT and UCF, the restitution issue that we discussed. They're entirely different vehicles here. The United Universal Money Traders is the foreign currency exchange, while the UCF, the Universal Currency Fund, is a hedge fund. This was completely. First of all, it wasn't advertised on the website. There were no active sales. Mr. Haas did not go out and actively seek these individuals. There's no issues of stop loss. It was administered separately by Kaplan & Company. Mr. Haas received a salary, and in fact, his entire salary for this vehicle was $4,194. That particular vehicle made money at the beginning. I think in a month-long period, it made almost $200,000. Additional to what its initial investment was, and then with the market just crashed. And there's nothing the government proposed in this particular case that there was any fraud involved in the Universal Currency Fund, in the trading, in the administration, in the salary draw, anything. They're saying that basically had they known that Mr. Haas was a horrible currency fund trader, they would have never entered this particular vehicle. So what they did was essentially put three or four representative clients who said, yeah, if he had told me that, I would have never invested. But we don't know about the rest of the investors. I mean, they're now saying that everything was fraud. every penny, every trade, everything that had to do with the universal currency was fraud, when in fact there's nothing on the record that could indicate that.
Do you point out any place where we can find any investors who, one, invested in UCF, suffered loss as a result, and whose investment was unconnected to some fraudulent conduct?
I don't understand. The UCF investors?
Right.
Well, there are only three or four that presented at trial that said they lost money as a result of a universal currency fund, and had they known that Mr. Haas was a horrible trader or had misrepresented his profits, they would have never invested. The rest of those investors in UCF never testified at trial. The rest of them couldn't have relied on any type of fraud that I'm aware of. So they wouldn't have lost money as a result of fraud. They lost money because there were bad trades.
You say that, but I tried to find, I mean, well, here we've got fraudulent conduct with respect to UMT. The judge is suggesting it's closely related to the losses suffered by the investors in UCF. And the reason why is because many of the of your clients invested in UCF based on purported performance in UMT. That's why they can link the two.
That's what he supposed, that those investors who did lose money invested because they felt that they were making, that UMT was making money, but that's not always the case. There were other individual investors that weren't brought into trial, that never testified at trial, that were part of the UCF, which we don't know why they invested. It's a hedge fund. It's a hedge fund that's a more secure vehicle. Once again, it was independently audited. It was administered by outside agencies, and there was no fraud involved in that. They just lost money because of the market and the trading that happened. If there's no further questions, I do.
Good morning. William Cole for the United States. May it please the Court. Turning first, Your Honor, to the issue of the admission of the NFA and CFTC sanctions, I want to point out, first of all, that there was, in fact, a jury instruction. It's a supplemental excerpt of Record 417 that made clear that these were not criminal convictions. So that was made very clear. The Court took great pains to make sure that the jury did not misconstrue the nature of those findings. However, it was not ever represented the truth about these sanctions. At first, during the initial period of UMT from 2002...
Pardon me, Counsel. Do you agree with your friend, Mr. Carlos, that Mr. Haas did not have to reveal that he had been sanctioned by NFA and CFTC to investors in UCF?
I do not agree with that because Mr. Haas did not remain silent about his background.
Let's start from scratch. If he hadn't said anything about his background, if he just said, my name is Haas, period, right, would he have had to have revealed NFA and CFTC sanctions?
I believe that because he was a fiduciary, he likely still would have had a legal obligation to disclose it.
Why was he a fiduciary?
Well, because he was accepting money, basically as a power of attorney, to trade on behalf of
the market. Do you think that a requirement of conviction is, judgment against Mr. Haas is that he was a fiduciary? Is that a requirement?
No.
Then why are you talking about it?
Only to respond to Your Honor's question. We never argued that his duty to disclose arose from a fiduciary.
Whoever is the statutory word, whoever makes a fraudulent statement, doesn't say whatever fiduciary.
That's right. The only reason I brought that up is...
Tell me again the basis, if you have one, for saying that starting from scratch, before he made any representations, he would have had to have revealed the NFA and CFTC sanctions. If that's your position.
Though that's not our position.
Well, then, all right. No, then
that's not. That's why I backtracked.
No. So then the failure to reveal becomes misleading only in light of something else he said. And that something else is?
That something else is his history. his history not only as to what he was supposedly doing over the years, which, in fact, he claimed to be doing things.
Where was that? Where was the evidence of what his history was in the trial record?
Yes, Your Honor. The history was at Supplemental Excerpt of Record, page 238, begins a series of that, – that is his prospectus for UCF. Also, there's the trading history on Supplemental Excerpt of Record 241 to 242, indicating trading is, as one of Your Honors mentioned earlier, indicating trading, for example, in 2000 and 2001, claiming a trading performance history for UMT in 2000 and 2001. Well, what was really going on in 2000 and 2001? Well, first of all, UMT didn't even exist. Instead, Mr. Haas was at Concord Trading, where he was engaging in the deceptive sales practices that resulted in the sanctions. And so we are not here to argue that someone has an automatic obligation to disclose past troubles to an investor. It is only because he chose to speak, or speak about his past. He spoke about where he supposedly had been, what his performance history supposedly was, and as mentioned earlier, he declared that he had the highest degree of ethics and responsibility.
Where does it say that?
Highest degree of ethics and responsibility is on Supplemental Excerpt of Record 244. And
it's in the website.
It was on the website. I'm sorry, yeah, that's the page site, but it was on the website. And so once he speaks in this manner, and even, Your Honor, when he gets to, when finally 2 years later, so he starts UMT in 2002. By 2004, by his own admission in surreptitiously recorded conversations, he says he knew he was busted, the money was gone, that he didn't think he'd have to tell anybody it was gone because he had powers of attorney and they never figured it out.
You know, I'm just wondering whether this wasn't overkill by the government by getting admitting or introducing the sanctions evidence. Also, I'm wondering, was it ever was there ever an objection made on 403 grounds that it was unfairly prejudicial?
Absolutely, there was. I don't recall right now if counsel used the number 403, but counsel argued pretrial and argued pretrial and motions and limiting rule hearings that it was prejudicial to his client, unduly prejudicial to his client. So that ground, I just can't remember if he cited the rule, but I believe that ground was definitely argued to the court. And Your Honor, I guess the overkill question goes, I would point out, to harmless error. I mean, even assuming the court erred, we don't believe the court did. The court had two bases, of course, to admit this as part of the scheme itself and as 404B evidence. The court found that both grounds justified admission.
How is it part of the scheme itself?
Well, if you look at cases like that are cited in the government's brief, like Wellington, Palandino, and Rebold, it gets back to the issue we were just addressing, which is the duty to speak comes if, in the course of the scheme, you misrepresent your past. And so as soon as you misrepresent your past, you now have an obligation to not conceal the truth about your past. And so that all goes not to 404B at all. That goes to being part of the scheme. And as I mentioned, Wellington, Palandino, and Rebold are three examples of cases where the court found exactly that. And in those cases, this court talked about, look, we're not going to the outer extreme and saying that someone always has to talk about their criminal convictions. But once they choose to start talking about their past in ways that are not accurate, now it's fraud if they don't disclose the truth. And of course, in the Ninth Circuit instruction itself for fraud, wire or mail fraud, it talks about half-truths and concealments. And the government's position under that ground for admission is that the court did not abuse its discretion in admitting for that purpose. There's also the 404B purpose. And then there's harmless error. And the government's position would be that even if the court abused discretion on both grounds, and we obviously don't believe it did on either, that the evidence was, in fact, overwhelming of the fraud in this case. I mean, this was people's retirement money was taken. It was busted, blown out through horrible trading activity without any regard for what their instructions were as to how many units to trade, without any regard for representations as to security and stop loss, and they were given monthly account statements claiming they were making money. All the while, sales representatives were out making phone calls seeking more money from investors. I mean, the evidence was overwhelming. And on to the restitution point that was raised by Mr. Haas, I want to first make sure that it's clear that this question as to restitution has no bearing on the guidelines or the custodial time. The government took a very conservative position at sentencing and chose the lower base, the lower offense level for a loss that would go all the way down to $2.5 million. And so this is purely a question as to the restitution judgment. And there, I would just point out that it's only a preponderance standard, and the court made findings. At Supplemental Excerpt of Record 212 to 213 and page 227, the court found several reasons that UCF was part of the same scheme as UMT. They were operated out of the same office. Haas was the principal of both. The court found that specifically found that based on the evidence before the court, no one would have invested in UCF but for the fraud that took place in UMT in concealing for so long the massive losses that were happening in UMT. And he also found that the prospectus itself misrepresented Mr. Haas's history. And that finding goes to the fact that in UCF, when Mr. Haas actually did disclose part of his NFA sanction, it was very deceptive. He claimed in the prospectus that he had been sanctioned for failing to supervise someone else. In fact, the NFA sanctioned him also for himself personally misrepresenting. And the misrepresentation was critical because it was so similar to what happened here. What he did in the earlier incident was he overstated the benefits of the investment and grossly misstated the risk. And that is identical to what happened in this case. And so the court, the indictment charged UCF and UMT as one scheme. The court found them to be one scheme. And the government submits that it did not abuse its discretion in ordering restitution to all of the victims.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right. So United States versus Hazzi is submitted, and this session of the court is adjourned for today.
Counsel, for the record, how do you say that your client's name?
Haas. Okay, you said it right the first time.
Well, we said Haas, and then somebody went to Hazzi, and then we went to Haas. So I thought we ought to have it once and for all. What it was. All right, thank you.